Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Egypt has long been seen as the cultural cornerstone of the Arab world. That cornerstone is rocking. Mubarak out, the Muslim Brotherhood's Morsi in. Now Morsi out, the military and mass protests up front again in the cause, maybe, of democracy and maybe not. This hour on Point, we're looking at the uproar in Egypt. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. How does this ancient nation find its footing in the current chaos? What do you make of the uprising to oust the country's first elected president? What do you make of the army stepping in to help? Where does this go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Last week, Wednesday, celebration in Tahrir Square as the crowds celebrated the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi. Why did they want him out? Well, here was protester Fahd El-Tarzi telling CBS News he believed Morsi was pushing an Islamist agenda too far.
It's a theocratic government. Instead of being ruled by a political dictatorship, we're now being ruled by an Islamic dictatorship, which is a lot worse.
Military coming in on the back of those protests to oust Morsi. Today, reports of, well, call it what you will, a massacre. Anyway, many dead. Here's sounds of an emergency vehicle siren near the scenes of today's killing. 40-plus, 300-plus injured outside an officers' club where Mohamed Morsi was rumored to be held in Cairo. Big numbers of dead at morning prayer time, dawn. Joining us first today from Cairo's Borzu Dargahi, North Africa and Middle East correspondent, for the Financial Times. Borzu, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you. What's the latest on what happened this morning?
There's conflicting accounts, but maybe not conflicting. There could be complementary as well. According to the Muslim Brotherhood and its supporters, they were at dawn prayers when suddenly there was tear gas being fired and the armed forces opened up with live fire, killing 42 people. According to the armed forces accounts, it's now trickling out. There was an attack on a military site by Islamists, by supporters of the deposed president, and that was followed by a confrontation in which many people died. So both sides are blaming each other. It's not clear who was the group responsible. It could very well be a small group of Islamist provocateurs did try to break into the military site and did provoke this attack on mostly innocent civilians at prayer.
Borzu, there are many people being quoted from the scene there saying there was no attack going on. There was just prayers. And on came the tear gas and the live fire with that very large toll of dead and wounded. Is that conceivable that the military would have simply opened up on people praying?
I don't think it's conceivable. I don't think it's in their interest. I don't think it's part of the roadmap of how the military was hoping to manage this whole situation. They were hoping for a quiet coup d'etat that would depose the Muslim Brotherhood, and then they would later try to bring the Muslim Brotherhood into the political process as a more minor character than it had been over the last couple years. This is flying in the face of that roadmap. This would make it very hard to reconcile with the Muslim Brotherhood. This would alienate a lot of very angry people who have access to weapons and an ideology that cherishes martyrdom. This would not be part of their game plan. I don't think someone would give the order to open fire on peaceful people at prayer.
And yet, 40-plus apparently dead and many hundreds wounded. The Muslim Brotherhood has now called for an uprising against, against the military, or in any case, those in charge, though who exactly that is unclear. I mean, people are saying, you know, don't plunge us into a situation like Syria. I'm looking here at the New York Times quoting a 23-year-old in the streets in Cairo, Borzu, saying everyone's worried about a civil war. That sounds so extreme, but does it feel that way in Egypt?
Well, there is this precedent. It doesn't really feel that way right now. Thankfully, it's not feeling that way. But there is this precedent. There was Algeria in 1992 in which the military stole an election from the Islamists, and the Islamists went out into the streets to protest, mostly peacefully, and the army opened fire, killing a lot of people, rounding up leaders of the Islamist movement, and igniting an 8-year civil war that continues to haunt the country of Algeria. And so there is this fear, there is this scenario, and right now, as of right now, with the behavior of all of the main participants in this conflict in Egypt, it seems like they're hurtling towards that scenario.
Hurtling towards it. You still seem to have some faith that it can be avoided. How? Over the weekend, there was this confusion about who would be leading the country. Mohamed El-Barde's name was put forward. What happened to that? And what's going on with the Al-Nur party, which had been the only Islamist party, really, to come out in favor of Morsi's ouster?
Yeah, I mean, that was the problem. Essentially, they had proposed Mohamed El-Barde, who is a former UN nuclear watchdog chief, a Nobel laureate, a prominent liberal and leader of a liberal left party in Egypt. And the Islamists, the ones that were supportive of the coup, vetoed that suggestion, saying that he's too political, that he's always been against the Brotherhood, that we needed a more neutral, technocratic figure to be the prime minister of this country. And so he was scuttled. And then last night there was rumors that another person, a social democrat, would be put in that position. And Noor also vetoed that suggestion. And then after this massacre, Noor has officially, at least for now, temporarily, left the sort of coalition that is overseeing the interim period right now in protest of this massacre. That's really bad. Basically, that means that Islamists have no representation in the authorities right now, with the Muslim Brotherhood under a clampdown and the Noor party essentially boycotting the ongoing negotiations.
Borzu, how could this move towards some kind of footing here? It seems so chaotic at the moment. The military came in and immediately spoke of elections, but how do you get from here to there?
Well, I don't know. I guess, for example, right now, 10 leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, according to the Human Rights Watch, 10 top leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, including the president and the number two of the Brotherhood, are locked up in prison. Maybe letting them out of prison would be a good idea if they wanted to reconcile with them. I don't know. And then perhaps kind of calling for quick elections in the next 6 months instead of the 2 years that has been bandied about by some military officials. Maybe that would be a good idea. Those are two possibilities for diffusing the tensions right now. And maybe not opening fire on peaceful protesters is a good idea as well.
Does it strike you as credible that the military is really prepared to be just a handmaiden of democracy here and then step to the rear?
Let's not talk about democracy. Let's talk about some semblance of pluralism and stability. I think that should be the goal, and I think that is something that the military could do, because in the past, between February 2011 and June 2012, when it had the control, when Egypt was under the direct control of the military, it was a disastrous period, and the military became a target for all sorts of scrutiny and anger and hatred. So I don't think they want to go back to being yelled at because of power cuts.
What about the Muslim Brotherhood and the lessons it's taking from this? I don't know if you've had a chance to speak to them. They're under so much pressure right now. Could they come back in and approach pluralism in a new way? That was one of the central critiques, that they had not been open to a kind of pluralistic sense of shared power when they had power.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is going to be a period. I have spoken to a lot of the Brotherhood people. I think there is going to be a period of examination and self-examination and critique and perhaps some kind of evolution on their part. There is a possibility that they could come back into the political scene. Certainly, they're passionate about politics and about Egypt and so on. Right for now at least, they're, under siege, and they feel that they're being attacked from all sides. So I don't think there's any kind of self-reflection at this point. They're in survival mode.
Borzu, how is the United States, Washington, being seen in this period of great flux in Cairo? How's its role being seen, and does it matter this time?
I think Washington does matter, and what Washington says has a lot of impact. The U.S. Is being in a really tough situation right now. Both sides accuse the other of being dupes for America. So because the Obama administration has somewhat stood up for the rights of the government here, the liberals and the leftists are accusing the U.S. of being supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is not the case at all. And meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood, because the army here gets a lot of money from the U.S. and there are close relations between some of the political players here and the West, the Muslim Brotherhood accuses the coup d'etat leaders of being in the hands of the U.S. and the Israelis and whatever conspiracy theories. So, yes, either way, the U.S. loses.
What's the mood? We just got you for half a minute, Borzu. What's the mood in the streets of Cairo today after this large killing and everything else we've seen in the last couple of weeks?
Gloomy and a lot of trepidation about what's ahead. A lot of people have suspended their business activities, are basically, stocking up a little bit on groceries, not in mass or anything like that. But there's a lot of worry about what's next for Egypt.
Gloom, trepidation, and today a lot of deaths in Cairo, Egypt. Borzu Dargahi joins us, correspondent there for the Financial Times, joining us from Cairo. Borzu, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Egypt in uproar again today. Democracy, stability, the future, all on the line. Sound of all that? This was Thursday. Egypt's interim president, Adli Mansour, sworn in, interpreted here by CNN.
I swear by Allah that I will remain faithful and I will respect the law and this constitution and then I will take care of the interests of the people and I preserve the independence of this country and all its territory.
Adli Mansour brought in there from the High Court, but that is not easy to preserve what he's hoping to preserve there. On Thursday last week, the day after Mohamed Morsi's overthrow, ouster, Dr. Hamza Zoba, spokesman for the Freedom and Justice Party, that's the political wing of the Muslim Brotherhood, acknowledged that there had not been perfect government, talking here with the BBC.
Yes, we acknowledged, we admitted that we made mistakes, but mistakes should be treated by another way, not this way. If we would like to, if anybody, any Egyptian would like to punish the president, the government, he has this right by vote, only by vote.
Only by vote, but we're past that now. Here in Alexandria on Friday, pro-Morsi demonstrators and riot police clashing. We'll go back to Cairo in a moment. Let's wait on in here with first Mona El-Gobashi. She is assistant professor of political science at Barnard College. Research focuses on political mobilization in contemporary Egypt. She is Egyptian, born and raised in Cairo, joining us today from New York. Mona, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Karim Haggag. He's a career Egyptian diplomat, currently on leave from the foreign ministry, teaching at the National Defense University in Washington. Karim Haggag, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
We're going to bring in a voice or two from Cairo in a moment as well. But Mona, just step back for a moment. Big picture, what is happening here?
What's happening is the latest stage of revolutionary upheaval. Egypt underwent an uprising in 2011, which broke one of the most powerful authoritarian regimes in the world. At the center of that regime was a very strong presidency. And ever since then, Egyptians of all stripes have been trying to and fumbling towards some sort of peaceful political struggle to reconstruct a form of legitimate authority in the presidency. On June 30th, 2012, there were the first competitive elections that Mohamed Morsi won mm-hmm. by the skin of an onion. Mm-hmm. But as you've seen in the over the past year, due to his failures of governance and the lack of any means of resolving conflict peacefully, that conflict went out onto the streets and culminated in this extremely grave and dangerous military coup.
Egypt trying to move here onto a democratic footing. Was the ouster of Morsi, in your view, Mona, justified by his shortcomings?
Well, failures of governance are almost part and parcel of a very vulnerable first-time elected government. Not to mention the fact that this government was the Society of the Muslim Brothers, who have been excluded from power for at least half a century. And so all observers realized the minute that Mohamed Morsi was elected that this would be no cakewalk. Now, whether that would actually justify a military deposing the president, that's a very controversial position that I disagree with. Being ousted by a popular uprising, however, is another matter.
I guess early days in a democracy, anything can happen, but this is, it's rough either way. Karim Haggag, what's your sort of big narrative of what's happening in Egypt right now? How do you describe it?
Yeah, Tom, I think Mona set the backdrop to this quite well. I just think that just to add to what she said, just in terms of the magnitude of what we've seen over the course of the last 2 weeks, during the uprising, we had on any given day on the streets nationwide in Egypt between 25 and 30 million protesters against President Morsi. These were called rightly by the BBC as the largest political demonstration in modern history. Now, I think the unfortunate thing, Tom, was that these protesters were actually calling for the ouster of President Morsi, not by a military coup, but through the ballot box by early elections. And this was a call that President Morsi, unfortunately, did not heed. Those calls, as is the case with any revolution, tended to escalate. And the protesters then called for the ouster of President Morsi. The military was faced with an extremely difficult choice. They could either intervene after a bloodbath had taken place or intervene to preempt a bloodbath. And they chose the latter course, knowing, of course, all the risks that this entailed. So this was a very difficult choice by the military that I don't think they were in any way eager to take this step. But I think it was President Morsi that really forced their hand on this.
Mona, we have seen in the streets these enormous expressions of dissatisfaction we saw with the Morsi government. But there's also now a lot of skepticism that what's really going on with the military is, at some level, a move to preserve deep military power sort of beneath and around the very almost infant structures of democracy in Egypt.
I agree with that. I differ with Mr. Haggag's depiction of the situation. I think the military wasn't forced to intervene. The military has been a key player in the Egyptian revolutionary drama the minute, of course, that President Hosni Mubarak was deposed on February 11th, 2011. The military has been very much an active steerer of this transition, if that's what you want to call it. And the first time that they, post-Mubarak, that they made a venture out into the public sphere was when Morsi faced very similar challenges back in November and December, and General Sisi stepped out and proposed a military-sponsored reconciliation. He invited all politicians to come and sit around the table. That was the moment when Sisi signaled that he may be interested in a much more active umpire role, if you will, in the political process.
Umpire, but then today, 40-plus dead, 300-plus wounded. Here was a spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood. This was Gihad el-Haddad talking with CBS News on Friday. He was asked if the Brotherhood felt specifically under attack by the military well before today's shooting.
Of course we're under attack. The military is trying to dismantle the Brotherhood machine and the Brotherhood organization, apparently for fear that if they actually hold the presidential election, we might show up for it and we might win it again.
Karim Haggag, how does Egypt reconcile the power aspirations of at least these three? There's the military, there's the Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam, and there's, however you want to describe, the aspiration of those huge crowds in the streets. How do you reconcile the secular, more liberal, I don't know what you call it. How do you reconcile these?
Well, Tom, I think the first thing is to note that it's really not for the military to reconcile these conflicting aspirations.
How does Egypt do it?
Well, I think that what the transitional president has signaled and the coalition that is standing behind him is that the first step that they've emphasized time and again is the need for reconciliation. If you look at the early steps that were undertaken by the interim president, There was no move to dissolve the Freedom and Justice Party, which is the political arm mm-hmm. of the Muslim Brotherhood. There was no attempt to crack down on the grassroots of the Brotherhood. Yes, there were scores of Brotherhood leaders that were arrested on very specific charges of incitement to violence. But the coalition that's standing behind the president has indicated time and again that the door is wide open for the Muslim Brotherhood to participate in this coming transitional phase. They have a seat at the table. They've indicated that they prefer a different course. They've indicated that they are prepared to exact a price for the ouster of President Morsi. And what we're seeing on the streets of Cairo is the early indications of them fulfilling that promise, unfortunately.
Mona,
but the way for reconciliation is open.
Mona, do you agree? A seat at the table? A lot of them were thrown in prison last week. We don't know where Morsi is.
From their perspective, this claim that they have a seat at the table, of course, falls on deaf ears. The Muslim Brothers, the way they've seen this is that, yes, they did a bad job at governance, but now they've been disenfranchised. They've had 1 year out of the constitutional 4 years, and not only was their president ejected and their top leaders arrested, their only TV station was shut down, in addition to several much more extremist right-wing religious TV stations, and their people are coming under attack. This is not the first time. Over the past week, there have been multiple clashes in which the majority of those dead are Muslim Brother members. So for the interim government to so, quote-unquote, extend a hand to the Muslim Brothers to come at the table, that feels very hollow.
Calls today from the Muslim Brotherhood for uprising. Call from the top Muslim cleric in the country. This is Sheikh Ahmed Al-Tayeb saying he will go into seclusion until the bloodshed ends. He's warning of civil war in Egypt. Howard's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts today. Hi, Howard. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Let me get to the phone. I was just a little bit removed from it.
Yeah.
The reason I'm calling is to comment on the Catch-22 situation in that, in my opinion, the theocracy is a total antithesis to democracy. And that's a straightforward, common-sense understanding. There's no place for religion in government. And the Muslim Brotherhood is a, in my opinion, dangerous organization. The prior president appointed a henchman of his to be the governor of the area of Luxor, where the Muslim Brotherhood murdered a large number of tourists for religious reasons.
But what do you do, Howard? It is big. It is deeply rooted. It is old, the Muslim Brotherhood. It has wide public support. So what do you do in a democracy? How can you just write it off?
No, not to write it off, but they have to understand that in a country that wants to claim democracy and democratic principles, theocracy has absolutely no place in it, and there's no place for religion in government.
Well, really not, I mean, okay, point taken. We'll look at that. Though, I mean, look at many countries. Look at American politics, if not government. Quite a bit of religion there in the last 20 years. Karim, do you see that Egypt has been under the rule of a theocracy since the election that put Mohamed Morsi in power?
No, I think no one's claiming that the Brotherhood ruled under the guise of a theocracy. I think the major failings of the Brotherhood were, as Mona said, first and foremost in the realm of governance, but also in the realm of politics. I mean, we had a president that ruled in a very majoritarian way, a very domineering way.
Not a pluralistic way.
He ran, unfortunately, as the president for all Egyptians as a candidate, but ruled as the representative of the narrow interests of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, one important thing to point out, Tom, this is not a religious secular divide that we're seeing in Egypt. The vast majority of those 25 to 30 million protesters that rose up represented, in general, the Egyptian center, which for the most part is pious, is very religious, is very conservative. But they had a very strong sense of unease by being governed by someone in the name of religion for a very authoritarian agenda.
When you say it's not a theocracy, that may be fair, but here I'm quoting from the New York Times. For Mr. Morsi's most strident opponents, they hated the blend of religion and politics that the president represented. The blend of religion and politics, that may not be theocracy, but that's a lot of religion that got in some people's goat.
No, that's correct. I think the feeling was that the blend of religion and politics really corrupted both. I mean, corrupted religion, which is held very dear by the vast majority of Egyptians, and the political aspirations of that vast majority for a more pluralistic and democratic government.
Let me get Tariq on the air. Tariq, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thanks. My point is very simple. That was the election of the people of Egypt. They elected the Brotherhood. It is none of the business of the army. The army needs to go back to its barracks where it belongs. I'm originally from Pakistan. The Pakistani government under General Musharraf also overthrew an elected government. The United States stood by and said, that's okay because we need Musharraf. The United States needs to make the decision where they decide whether they support democracy or they're going.
Tariq, you're breaking up, but we've got your point. Mona, look, the Muslim Brotherhood was elected, so just deal with it, Tariq says. And what's your response?
I personally agree with that. Unfortunately, the situation in Egypt is far more complicated than that. To discipline the military, to civilianize Egyptian politics, to put the military firmly under civilian control is going to be and was really the struggle of the uprising that began on January 25th, 2011. And the election of Morsi, imperfect and suboptimal as it was a very defining moment because it did two things. It incorporated the largest social movement in Egyptian history that had been out of power for half a century.
The Muslim
and the second thing, mm-hmm. the Muslim Brothers. And the second thing that it did was it set the country on one of the most important struggles of any nascent democracy, which is putting the military back in the barracks. And in that context, what happened last Wednesday, the coup d'etat against a failed and inept president set the country back decades.
But what do you say to critics of Morsi, and there were many in the streets, saying that what he was ruling over was a kind of, yes, first elected, but then sort of slow-motion coup, that by the time of next elections, a couple, 3 years out, the Muslim Brotherhood, his government, would have so marginalized its opponents that it would be one-party rule forever.
I agree with Karim on this point. I think that Mohamed Morsi's signature failing was that every time he faced serious challenges, he retreated into his base rather than reaching out to potential sympathizers, many of whom, by the way, voted for him very reluctantly, but they voted for him nonetheless because they wanted to keep out Mubarak's former prime minister. Now, Morsi, instead of widening his base of supporters, instead of bringing Egyptian citizens with him in the struggle against the so-called deep state, these vestiges of unelected authority in the Egyptian state that refused to deal with an outsider elected president, instead of doing that, very unfortunately, he bunkered down among his supporters and lent himself and themselves a bunker mentality and a victim mentality that ultimately led to where we are today.
And the analysis that says, look, here and beyond, political Islam does not know how to share power. What do you say to that, Mona?
I think this has always been the bugbear that has tracked political Islam ever since it came onto the scene in Middle East politics in the mid-80s, and it is and continues to be purely speculative. Remember, the reason why Morsi being in power was such an extraordinary experiment for the entire Middle East was here was the first time that the largest Islamist movement in the Middle East, not the first, was Hamas
yep.
in 2006, but the largest, the mother Islamist movement was in power, and here was its chance to prove that it could govern without the and ending the democratic experiment.
But weren't the Egyptians in the streets saying that it failed?
They did, and that's most unfortunate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Egypt in uproar again. 40-plus dead in shootings this morning outside the Republican Guard Officers Club in Cairo. At dawn prayer time, a dispute over what happened there, but the Muslim Brotherhood clearly calling it massacre. Military saying self-defense. We're looking at democracy, stability, the future, all on the line in Egypt. And because Egypt is such an important country in this part of the world, implications well beyond as well. Mona El-Ghobashi is with us. Egyptian, born and raised in Cairo, joins us from Barnard College in New York. And Karim Haggag is with us, career Egyptian diplomat currently on leave from the foreign ministry there at the National Defense University in Washington. He was a director of press and information at Egypt's Washington Embassy 07 to 11. So back in Mubarak years. We're going to go in just a second to Cairo again. Where does this go? Top cleric, Muslim cleric in the country today, saying he's going into seclusion until everyone settles down. He's warning of civil war. In his speech last week, before his ouster, the then president, Mohamed Morsi, said he would sacrifice his blood for the country, for, well, his stake in it.
If the price of safeguarding the legitimacy is my blood, then I am prepared to sacrifice my blood for the sake of stability and security of this homeland.
And the legitimacy of his leadership. The next day, Egyptian Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi here announcing on national television that Morsi was no longer in power and the constitution suspended.
And the roadmap will follow as follow. Suspend the constitution.
Mona, Karim, please stand by. I want to go to Cairo again. And while Khalil, an engineer by profession, a longtime activist against the Mubarak regime, he voted for Mohamed Morsi, but like millions of Egyptians, then called for him to step down. Wael Khalil in Cairo, thank you very much for joining us. Are you concerned that Israel could descend even into civil war, or is that exaggeration, Wael?
I am. I think the call of civil war is very exaggerated. I think we are living in a very complex situation. There's a strong movement that mobilized against Morsi on the 30th of June and before. There's a utter failure of the Morsi government and of himself to bring on board the right coalition he promised, and failures to deal with the challenges facing the government, and failure to deliver any of his promises to improve the livelihood of the individuals, of the individual Egyptians. And I think I'm one of the people who believe that he should be removed even before his term, because many people, myself included, believe that we could not really tolerate 4 years of this failure. And actually, yep, not only failure, but a continuous demonization of opponents, and that's on one level. So the mobilization is genuine and quite, in my opinion, democratic, because it called for early elections.
Your line is a bit rough to Cairo, forgive me, but let me ask, do you trust the Egyptian military to put the country back on a path of democracy, pluralism, to give up power to a non-military authority?
Absolutely. We have a very, very bad experience with the military over the year and a half after the coming of Mubarak, where we saw them incidents of bloodshedding of protesters, of trying to cling to power or to influence developments on the political scene. So on one level, we don't have enough to trust the military. On the other hand, we do have an experience of actually foiling the original attempts in the past 3 years. So we have more confidence in our sides. And I think that they might have learned a bit. I mean, when they stood in front of cameras last time, so they had a large coalition around them and really saying, it's not us, we're not in power. This is the interim president from the Constitutional Court. That is very much involved in the arrangements.
The line is so rough, but I think I hear you there saying the military has a coalition around them. They brought in the interim president, and I think I hear you expressing some confidence that they will push in the right direction here. Let's see if we can get a better line there. I'm so glad you're with us. Let me get a couple of voices from our callers in. Daryl in Columbia, South Carolina. Daryl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The problem with Egypt is they had the cart before the horse. They held elections before the constitution was completed, which allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to continue existing religious inequalities in the constitution to remain, and added new religious requirements. The Constitution granting religious equality and separation of religion and state should be completed before any new elections are held. This would assist in removing some of the ability of majority Islamic parties to force their religious principles on the people and continue the religious inequality in Egypt.
Yeah, the Constitution itself came out of a period of dispute and controversy. Mona, what about it? Did the Muslim Brotherhood act fairly in the arrangement, you know, around the drafting of the Constitution itself? And how does Egypt get to a workable constitution in this kind of period of flux?
Yeah, this is a really important point. The sequencing of elections versus constitution was one of the main, if not the main, issue in the transitional period before Morsi's election. And the Muslim Brothers were very ham-handed in the way they dealt with this. They pushed for elections because they knew, of course, that they would be the dominant party in those elections. They did show some signs of inclusiveness in the constituent assembly that was writing the constitution. However, because Morsi took these decrees in November 21st, that was really the death knell of any sense of consensus on the Constitution. So though it was passed by a 64% approval rating back in December, the voter turnout was very low, 33%. And the Constitution is tailed by this sense that it's illegitimate. So we're going to have to open that up again. But again, under military rule now.
Mustafa calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Mustafa, you're on.
Yes, sir. What is happening in Egypt is not a military coup. I was lately in Egypt on May 20th. You know, my brother died at the time and I went there, and the sentiment of the people was completely against this failed presidency. Nixon was elected here with a landslide in 1972, and because he did not abide with the Constitution, he lied, he was forced to resign.
Richard Nixon and Watergate and all the rest, okay.
Yes, we have actually more than Watergate in Egypt. And, you know, if you see what happened in Alexandria when the jihadists throw two kids from high, you know, story building, you know, these people are murderers. These people are what, you know, Bush 9/11 here, okay? It's I cannot understand how the United States, you know, support what is called democracy when it's really, in reality, is not a democracy.
Well, I mean, it's hard to expect perfection when a country is moving into democracy for the first time. On the other hand, that's an interesting, to go back and cite Watergate and the ouster of Richard Nixon in America's own historical experience. Mustafa, I appreciate your call. One more here from Buffalo, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I don't know much about Egypt. But from what I understand, prior to even 2011, the Egyptian military was the true backbone of the economy. And so whether you change the president, no matter whether you bring in religion and whether you bring in the Muslim Brotherhood, the one thing that hasn't changed is the military's control. And who would be more threatened by democracy than the group of people who are actually controlling the economy?
Chris, you put your finger on a very important point. And Mona, I wondered about this from the very first instant. You can do what you like in Tahrir Square, but I think Chris is exactly right, that the Egyptian military, sort of like in China maybe, is deeply wired into the economy well beyond just a complex, you know, actual ownership. And doesn't that put a finger on the scales of almost everything?
Yes, indeed. Chris is right. This is one of the key vestiges of authoritarianism that we've had to deal with. The Egyptian military also, ever since 1979, has been receiving $1.3 billion in aid from the U.S. military. And so it's not just the unmoved mover in Egyptian politics, it's also this massive leviathan in the Egyptian economy. That's why, as imperfect and as halting as it is, these early steps toward Egyptian electoral democracy were very significant because they, at the very least, put the military in a position where it would have to negotiate its status in the future Egypt. Before that, they were a state above the state. They didn't have to negotiate with anybody. A nascent democracy starts to have the military have to answer for some of its activities. And it was a very long uphill struggle. And the coup on Wednesday, yes, indeed, it was a very popular coup, but that makes it more deadly. The coup on Wednesday set that back because it means that the military is going to go back to its position as this unquestioned fourth estate in Egyptian politics.
While Khalil in Cairo, how do you get the Egyptian military out of its, let's say, tremendous power in the economy to begin to have a real balance of power and citizen power in the country while?
One of the things, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. One of the things that that we on the opposition opposed Morsi and his party in the constitution that was pushed last December was that it maintained the above normal status of the military, and it puts it away from popular accountability. And this is one of the things that Morsi has failed to really bring in the military to be accountable to the elected officials. And this one, of course, we have 60 years of military rule one way or the other.
Yeah. Oh boy, we've got interference again there now. While I'm sorry, but hard to put it back in the box, as you and Mona say, once it's brought out at such a critical moment in Egyptian history. Let's take a call from St. Louis, Missouri. Corey's calling. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for my taking my call.
Sure.
I know that in countries like ours, like America, we appreciate democracy as it is. And a lot of us would love to see democracy flourish in other countries like Egypt. But my question is, because we have separation of church and state, and because we have a religious tug of war going on in Egypt now, I don't know if democracy will ever be a flourishing type of endeavor for Egypt because of the fact that they cannot separate religion from the aspect of politics.
Corey, let us pick it up. Karim Haggag, what about it? Should Americans look with hope and supportively toward Egyptian democracy as something that will ultimately work out? You hear Corey's misgivings from St. Louis.
Well, I think, Tom, this is a difficult time. I think, as your reporters on the ground mentioned, a lot of Egyptians are looking with sort of tenuous hope on what this process brings. I think, though, there are signs of optimism. I mean, the fact that we did have this massive uprising of the Egyptian center, which very much knows what it doesn't want. I mean, it rejected the authoritarianism of President Mubarak. It rejected the continuation of military rule, as was rightly mentioned by your caller in Cairo when we had massive demonstrations against the military during the time they were in charge. And they rejected a renewed form of authoritarianism, this time under a religious guise. It's very clear the aspirations of what the broad majority of Egyptians want. It is a difficult path to get from where we are now to a situation that realizes those aspirations for democracy and pluralism. But I think that the cause for hope, Tom, is what we're seeing in Egypt is that the people have taken matters into their own hands. Now, that is a situation that is fraught with risk. There's no doubt about it. But I think those risks are exaggerated. I don't think those 30 million people that are mobilized will allow the military to come back and resume power in Egypt.
And what about political Islam, Mona, on the other side of this ouster? You know, we've been reading, not just in Egypt, but from all over the region, Islamist leaders saying, hey, wait a minute, we tried to go with democracy in Egypt, and look, we just got booted out. Why should we try that again? And yet it's a big and strong force in the region. For Egypt and for the region, what is the example of what we've just seen mean, Mona?
Well, I think that's one of the most sobering and disturbing lessons that many Islamist movements are going to take from this Egyptian example, which everybody was watching with bated breath to see how the Egyptian experiment in Islamist-led halting democratization would go. Because, as you pointed out to me earlier, there's always the claim that Islamists will take over power and then proceed to destroy democracy and set up a theocracy. And this was the time where you would actually see Islamists fumbling towards governance, being normalized as normal political actors with which you can disagree out on street protests and in elections. But once you bring in the military to abort this experiment and tell the Islamist voters, their sympathizers, their cadres, tell them basically that, well, you can participate on our terms, which means that you can never rule. And you just have to be on the sidelines and sort of take our cue on how you should participate. That's not at all a message that's going to be taken lightly by the Islamist sympathizers in this region.
Could the Muslim Brotherhood be sobered by this and say, okay, you know, we'll come back and we won't be heavy-handed. We won't push for as much control. We won't try and mix religion and politics with the same hard edge as we did under Morsi. Could they come back and just do it differently?
I think the long term is that's what they're going to be doing. They're going to be drawing lessons and they're going to learn from Morsi's experience and they're going to try to reach out. The short term, however, which is what we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, is they're going to be taking the opposite lesson from that, which is we tried our best. People didn't give us the benefit of the doubt. They were waiting for us to fail. And once we failed, they cheered our failure and they rubbed it in our face. I think that's what we're seeing in Egypt now.
In the next, I don't know, days, couple of weeks, 3-4 weeks, a month, Mona, what do you think would help pull this away from the edge of sometimes looks like chaos?
It's very difficult to say, and the violence doesn't make it any easier. Hopefully, the Muslim Brothers will be given a real option to come to the table, not these sort of fake attempts to bring them in to justify a military-led transition.
Mona El-Ghobashi at Barnard College, joining us today from New York, Egyptian Cairo, born and raised. Mona, it's been wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for your insights this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Wael Khalil in Cairo, wonderful to have you with us, and thank you for your time today. And Karim Haggag, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much, Karim, for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.